Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Thanks so much for being here with us on this Monday afternoon. Well, it's Monday afternoon where we are. Maybe it's Monday evening where you are. Maybe it's Tuesday morning where you are. Wherever you are, we're awful glad you're here to spend the time with us. And I am just glad to be back here. It always feels so good to be back doing this after the weekend. We've got 2 hours of open forum for you. You can call and ask anything you want. And we've got Joe Heschmeyer as our guest, just one of the best Catholic apologists in the world, the author of a whole bunch of books, including the most recent one, which is The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. Joe Heschmeyer, thanks for being here with us.
My pleasure.
You look like you're waiting for me to say something negative about you. Why? What is this?
I know, I'm kind of shocked it's taking you this long.
I'm not going to say anything negative about you.
You must be under the weather.
No, I'm feeling fine. It's Thanksgiving week. I'm in the holiday spirit, and I'm going to, fake it. The number is 888-318.
Hey, you made my list just one longer right there. On Thursday, I'll be like, man, Sly was nice to me today.
That'll be, when everyone's going around saying what they have to be thankful for. You can say on Monday, Cy and I got along really well on the radio.
I think that might be a red flag for all of my friends and family members. We'll be like, you need to work on that relationship.
888-318-7884. 888-318-7884 is the number. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest, and you can ask anything you want. And we most particularly want to make clear that you don't have to be Catholic to call. You don't have to be Christian to call. You don't have to be religious to call. Anybody can call. Maybe something about the Catholic faith puzzles you, or you just don't know why Catholics believe that or do that. Maybe you have a very complex question. Maybe you'll think, I don't know if I should call. It's very simple. A lot of times the simplest questions are the most fun to deal with, and we have the best conversation. So whatever your question, feel welcome here. 888-318-7884. You know what I'm really doing, Joe, is we're doing the Thanksgiving show, you, me, and Chris. And I'm avoiding talking about, because now I got all the topics in my head for that, and I don't want to accidentally talk about them with you now. So I'm exercising.
Are you saying you don't have enough material for two shows?
No, that's not what I'm saying. It's two different kinds of shows. We're going to do the flannel panel for Thanksgiving. And since I did all the research today and got the audio files, I know what we're going to be talking about. And it's just hard once you have that work done not to talk about those things. 888-318-7884. Sorry, I interrupted you, Joe, with the phone number.
Oh, no, I didn't know you were giving the number. I was going to say it's like opening the Christmas presents ahead of time. My Father's Day, my little sister, when she was, I don't know, maybe five, on Father's Day, looked at my dad's watch and says, oh, that's kind of an old watch. I hope you get a new one. So he had a pretty good idea what he was getting for Father's Day.
How helpful of her. She was so clever. She had no idea that her father could see through that. Joe, we have in studio with us some young people from NET Ministries, which is National Evangelization Teams, young Catholics traveling across the country, enriching Catholic culture among the youth. And I guess we're going to get to them in a minute. I was going to go right to them, but it says there's a little note that says one moment. Then we're going to go to Claire in Denver, Colorado, who's from NET Ministries. But you knew about NET Ministries. I didn't know about NET Ministries, or if I did, I had forgotten.
I believe we actually have a former Catholic Answers person who, Hector Molina, I think he did some stuff with NET, but I may be misremembering. That may be, I'm thinking of casting nets. I do know NET Ministry, though, because we do know some of their missionaries who now live in Kansas City. So it's somewhat similar to, what you might be familiar with like Focus or St. Paul's Outreach or. It's a good ministry.
Well, Claire's ready. They've got the mic on there in the studio for her. Claire, you got a question for Joe?
Being a missionary, we encounter lots of questions on a daily basis. And one of the questions that has been coming up is being Catholic the only way to get to heaven?
That's a great question. And the answer, like most good questions, is yes and no, depending a little bit on what you mean. So we want to avoid two errors. One error is suggesting that there's some way other than Jesus, or that Jesus has some church other than the church that he founded. That's one error. You don't want to end up with saying, just be a good Buddhist, just be a good Muslim, be a good whatever, and that's good enough. But the other error is we don't want to reduce salvation to a theology quiz, where you know, at the end of your life, you get grilled on how many natures did Christ have, and can you answer what the catechism says on that section? Neither of those is the proper Christian understanding of what Jesus comes to do. And one of the clear indications we get is in Acts chapter 17. St. Paul goes to the Areopagus, which is Mars Hill, and he says there that as he was passing along, this is in verse 23, he says, in observing the objects of your worship, notice they're pagans, they're polytheists, they have multiple gods. He said, I found an altar with the inscription to an unknown god. What therefore you worship is unknown, this I proclaim to you. Now that's a really remarkable claim, because Paul is saying that there's a whole group of people who are ignorantly worshiping the true God. That doesn't mean their worship is perfect. It doesn't mean they're totally Orthodox. Clearly they're not, because this isn't the only object of their worship. But among the gods that these pagans are worshiping, the true God is one of them. That's what he says pretty explicitly. And then he explains, beginning in verse 24, a better way to worship God. And then he goes on to say that God will overlook those errors done in ignorance. So he says in verse 30, the times of ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all men everywhere to repent. In other words, if you're a pagan in the first century who's never heard of Jesus Christ, you're not being punished for having not happened to hear about him yet. And that's true if you're a pagan in the 21st century who lives somewhere where the word of Jesus hasn't been preached yet. You're judged based on what you've received and how you've responded to what you receive. So this is a principle laid out in Luke 12:48, that to whom much is given, much will be expected. To whom more is given, more is expected. So the more you have, the more you're responsible for. Think about the parable of the talents. One man has five, one has two, another has only one. They're judged based on what they did with the gifts God gave them, not what they would have done with the gifts God gave their neighbor. And that includes the gift of revelation, that if you have received more of the truth, you're accountable for more of the truth. But the last thing that we have to be so clear to say here is that sometimes people hear all that and say, wouldn't it be better to remain in ignorance? And the answer is no, because we have a good God that when you're exposed to more of the truth, that doesn't just make your theology quiz harder, something like that. No. This helps you to live a life more in accordance with how you were made. It helps you to be happier now. It helps you to be happier in heaven. And it makes it more likely that you'll say yes to God the more you come to know and come to love him. So being Catholic is the proper way. Those people who err in an ignorant, innocent sort of way are not going to go to hell because they made some mistake that they weren't accountable for. But that doesn't mean some other way is equally valid or just as good as being Catholic.
What do you think, Claire?
No, I think that's beautiful, just a way to explain it, especially because we're doing these retreats for our high schoolers and we're trying to, you know, answer things like answer these types of questions in a loving way. That's also going to, I guess, move them to the truth. And so, no, that's very helpful and I appreciate it.
Oh, good. Good. Well, that's wonderful. Well, praise God for what you're doing in reaching high schoolers. This is a pivotal time. I know, I'm sure if you look at the numbers, the age at which most people leave the Catholic faith is late high school or early college. And so if you can help give them those answers to those kind of hard questions when they're first asking them, you can really help kind of steady the ship as they embark on what are often some pretty turbulent seas.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, God bless you in your work, Claire. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. You're welcome to call with your question, 888-318-7884. And we got a big announcement that's very important to Joe Heschmeyer's life. We'll do that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the reasons we should go to Mass is because, if you look in the Catechism, you will see the fruits of Holy Communion. And these are remarkable things that we can receive at every Mass that we attend. We encounter the risen Lord, and he shares something of his divine life and love with us.
The Holy Sacrifice of the Mass, live from the EWTN Chapel, every morning, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Thanks so much for being here with us. It's open forum today, and Joe Heschmeyer is our guest both hours. You're welcome to call with any question you've got, 888-318-7884. And let me first give you, before we get to the big news from Joe Heschmeyer, and it's big news for Joe Heschmeyer, but more importantly, it's big news for the entire planet Earth. So we'll get to that in 1 second. But I want to let you know about our programming this week. We're not going to slack this week. We're going to have brand new programming for you every day of the week, including Thanksgiving and the day after Thanksgiving, also known as Black Friday, because that is the day when, I don't know, people murder one another for cheap goods. I don't know how else to describe Black Friday. Maybe it's not murder. It's just commit indignities against one another. Joe, you have a huge, huge endeavor coming up. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So speaking of new content that's coming up very soon, today is November 21st. On December the 1st, in addition to being the feast day of St. Edmund Campion, next Thursday, a week after Thanksgiving, is also the launch date of my new podcast called Shameless Popery. Some of you may be familiar with my blog, Shameless Popery. I've had since 2009. It's, you know, now old enough to see PG-13 movies if it was animate. and it, you know, the whole course of that was just me answering questions that Protestants and atheists and everybody else had about Catholicism. And it's been a really lively 13-year conversation. And so I want to kind of carry that forward in a new forum, because I've seen a shift in the way people engage with content, so to speak, you know, from reading really long blog posts to now listening to stuff, as I'm sure listeners here can attest. So it'll be available both in podcast form, wherever you get podcasts. It'll also be available in video on YouTube. So if you know how to use YouTube and can type in Shameless Popery, P-O-P-E-R-Y, you'll find it beginning December 1st.
December 1st, big day. Joe, congratulations on that. We've been working on getting these new podcasts out, and I know Edgar's done a lot of work on it, but the bulk of it, of course, falls on you, and congratulations on the new podcast coming out.
Thanks. That's a big deal. I'm really indebted to Edgar, to John Versillo, to Jack, to Andrew Hermes for just really doing a lot of the behind-the-scenes stuff that's often really thankless work. It's the difference between, let's just say, the quality of product I would put out in terms of audio-visual production wouldn't have been the same otherwise. Oh, and a special thank you to Christine Venditti as well for doing the intro and exit music. Or intro and exit talking, whatever, the voiceover.
And she did a very, very nice job. And boy, it's exciting times at Catholic Answers. And, you know, last week we got to say thanks to our supporters again. I'll say thanks again. But this is among the things that we're able to do because of your very kind and generous support. We're able to move out now into the podcasting sphere with good material. We're not starting from zero. These are well-researched, well-prepared, and really good-looking new podcasts that are coming out. So check them all out. And now we'll go back to the phones. I said back to the phones, but we haven't gone to the phones yet, have we? We had
sure haven't.
Claire in studio. And we'll have some more questions from in studio. But this one's Jason in Staten Island, New York, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Jason, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Joe. No, Jason? All right. Let me try. Jason, yeah. Are you there with us?
Yes.
Okay, we didn't hear you before, so go ahead and start with your question for Joe.
So I'm an Anglican. I was an Episcopalian / Anglican for the last 10 years, 10, 15, yeah, about 10 years. And my question is, why do Catholics believe they're the one true church, and how did it come to that? Because sometimes it bothers me when I hear it over and over, because it makes me feel like, am I not worshiping Jesus the way I should, or am I worshiping a different Jesus? And sometimes I'm not trying to be sensitive, but it just how it makes me feel like, wow, maybe I'm not doing it right, or I'm not worshiping the same God or the same Jesus.
Jason, I think that's a great question. And I want to affirm that you are worshiping the same Jesus. Now, the second question is, are you worshiping him correctly? You know, and this is an important question, because even if you look throughout the Bible, like look, especially in the Old Testament, the number of times Israel tried to offer worship to God other than what God had asked for. This gets into some really big questions. What is the worship God is asking us for? You know, what does that mean in terms of the Eucharist or the Lord's Supper? What does it mean in terms of what your Sunday liturgy ought to look like? But then also, as you said, what about church membership? Did Jesus found one true church? And if so, what is that church? So here's why Catholics believe that the Catholic Church is the one true church. The starting piece of data would be Matthew 16, verse 17 to 19. Jesus says to Peter, "You are Peter," which means rock, "and upon this rock I will build my church." Now, that already suggests that Peter is going to have something special to do with the church, but we'll get to that part in a sec. The other part to notice is he says, "I will build my church." That Jesus is saying he's going to give us a church. Jesus doesn't give us the book of the Bible directly. He does give us a church directly. And that's a really important piece of information, because if Jesus didn't do that, then his followers would be left to form their own denominations. You know, Paul would form one over here, Peter would form one over there, James would form one over there, just like the reformers do in the 16th century. But Jesus says he's going to give us a church, that it's not something left to men to create. You know, if we want to know the history of Anglicanism, we know it was created by Henry VIII in the 16th century. We can trace its origins to the beginning, and its origins aren't Jesus Christ founded it in Matthew 16. So that's the first data point. The second is in Matthew 18. Jesus says, if you've got a controversy, you take it to your brother, then you do it in two or three. And then if he refuses to listen even to like the two or three of you, you're told in verse 18, tell it to the church. That tells us something about the church. It has to be visible, and it has to be capable of settling disputes when they arise. And so whatever Jesus means by the church, he clearly means something visible and capable of acting in a kind of adjudicatory manner. We see that also in Acts 15. There's a theological controversy, the Judaizer controversy, that arises. The church meets at council, settles the question, and then declares their resolution in the form, "It seemed good to the Holy Spirit and to us." That's Acts 15, 28. We're also told in Matthew 5, verse 14, "You're a light of the world, a city set on a hill, and a light that can't be put under a bushel basket." Now, these days in America, we often use that city on a hill language to refer to the USA. But obviously, that's not what Jesus is talking about. In the original context, Jesus is talking about the church. And what he's saying is that it's organized like a city, and it's visible. That's why the city's on a hill. That's why it's a light that can't be put under a bushel basket. So it's a visible, organized society. That's what Jesus means by the church. He doesn't just mean the collection of Christians known only to God. He doesn't just mean the invisible collection of the saved. He means a visible, organized society, the new people of God. And if you say, okay, given that, what do we know about that church? Well, you can trace it throughout history. It's the Roman Catholic Church. And now, important in that is also the role of St. Peter. St. Peter is told that in Luke 22, all the 12 are told that they're to be the servant leaders of the people of God, that they're not to lord their authority over the others, they're to be servants of others. And then Simon Peter is told, "Simon, Simon, Satan has desired to sift all of you as wheat, but I've prayed for you, Simon, that your faith may not fail, and when you have turned back, strengthen your brethren." In other words, Jesus, knowing that the 12 apostles are going to face the greatest spiritual challenge of their life, handles this by praying for one of them. Not all 12. He doesn't just divinely stop the threat from happening. He prays for one of them, Simon Peter, and entrusts the spiritual welfare of the other 11 to him, knowing that this is the same Simon Peter who's going to betray him three times. So all that's to say, there's a church that Simon Peter has a special, singular kind of role as the servant of the servants of God. It's a visible, structured society. We can trace that church throughout history. Every bishop of Rome, from St. Peter on down to Pope Francis today. That's why we believe that the church, the Roman Catholic Church, is the church spoken of in Scripture, because all of the biblical and the historical evidence points to that. What do you think of that, Jason? Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, I know Anglicanism is different, but we're really the same. And if you know, like, after Henry VIII, all the Catholic priests became, most of them became Anglican priests. Our Book of Common Prayer, our first rite, our second rites are based on the Catholic rites. Our liturgical setup is based on the Catholic way. I mean, we're really Catholic. We have high church. We, you know, there's a lot of similarities. So, I mean, but that was really just the thing, just hearing that all the time. And to me, it kind of sounded arrogant in a way, like, oh, you know, we're the one true church, we're better than you. That's how I always, you know.
Yeah. And you know what? If the church was a man-made institution, that would be an arrogant claim. Like, if I just said, I've got the way, the truth, and the life, and I just meant that I'm really smart, then I would be incredibly arrogant. And every non-Christian would be like, look at how arrogant you Christians are, thinking you got it all figured out on your own. But it's not arrogant to say, I think God has given us something we couldn't have given ourselves. It's not arrogant for Christians to say, we've got the one way. And it's not arrogant for Catholics to say, we've got the one church. As long as we're saying, this is a gift we got from God and not something we gave to ourselves. So I think you're right that there's a lot that Anglicanism has preserved. There's a lot of really beautiful, especially liturgical stuff, that they have from their Catholic past. Our chaplain is actually a convert from Anglicanism, and he's part of what's called the Anglican Ordinariate, which takes the liturgical beauty of Anglicanism and reincorporates it into the full unity of the Catholic Church. And so it takes, I think, the best of both worlds in that sense, because there really is a beautiful English patrimony in terms of the liturgy and worship. But you don't want to be cut off from the fullness, because Henry VIII really decisively breaks away from the Catholic Church. And then you see it again under Edward and Elizabeth. It is a really decisive push against Catholicism. Catholicism's even outlawed as a capital crime for a priest in England. You know, you've got 40 Jesuit martyrs just in Cambridge alone. This is something we don't want to lose sight of, that England made the decision not to be Catholic, but still to hold on to some of those vestiges. I would suggest those vestiges are good, but let's bring them back into the fullness of the body. We don't want to have a part of the body cut off from the whole. That's not what Christ intends. In John 17, he prays that all his followers will be one, as he and the Father are one. So that's something we should be praying really earnestly for the union of Christians, for the unity of Christians.
Jason, thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate that call. It is open forum. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest, and we have some very fine guests from Net Ministries in the studio with us today. That's National Evangelization Teams, young Catholics who travel around enriching Catholic culture among the youth. And up next, we have Joe from New Hampshire. Joe, are you there with us? Do we have Joe?
Yep, I'm here.
Oh, hey, Joe. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Yeah, so in regarding sainthood in the Catholic Church and being canonized, my question is, the Church recognizes saints after they perform two miracles, and I was just wondering where that comes from.
Oh, yeah, sure. My understanding is that process is substantially started in kind of an organized way by Pope Innocent III. That before that, so he is 1198 to 1216. Before him, it was much more just like popular acclaim. The people would just say, oh, yeah, that guy's a saint. But the church wanted something a little more organized, a little more like methodical. And it's undergone some other changes since. And most recently in 1983, Pope John Paul II reworked the canonization process, and he laid all of that out in an apostolic constitution. So this is something that the church has the power to do, but then the question of like how best to exercise that authority is left to human prudence to a large extent. So just for those who don't know, like it, to become a saint, the church has several steps. This does not mean like if you're a saint, you're already in heaven. We're not saying you're not in heaven until we finish the paperwork. But for us to know you're in heaven, there's a lot of things we want to look at. We want to look at the holiness of your life, and that includes reviewing whatever paper trail you left in life, which we can, in the case of modern saints, can take forever because, you know, think about how many emails and text messages and everything else you write. They want to look at all that stuff and see, were you privately the same kind of person you were publicly? And what do we know about your life from everyone, everything around you? And then let's put some supernatural cases before you, some cases that left to human devices, we'd be unable to resolve these things. And if miracles start happening with your intercession, that's a really good confirmation that you actually are in heaven. So only at the end of that does the church use her authority to declare that you're actually a canonized saint. It's a long process intentionally, because we don't want a situation where we just assume somebody's a saint and then it turns out they were living a double life, or even that there was just some scandal, even if they are holy. We don't want, to be spending the next 500 years explaining why we declared a saint this person who had maybe a really checkered past we didn't know about, or whatever the case may be.
Does that work for you, Joe?
Yeah, perfect. Thank you so much. And I had another question, if that's all right.
We have short time until the hard break, so go ahead.
All right, cool. So kind of in regards to sainthood and stuff, what are your guys' thoughts on praying to past relatives who, to our knowledge, were very holy, devout Catholics?
Very good question, Joe. Yeah. I'll tell you what.
It's a devotional practice. I think it's fine, but it's a devotional practice. You're not declaring them infallibly in heaven, but those small things are how the devotional thing happens that often leads to someone being declared a saint. Is enough people do that.
Right back with more awesome. Open Forum with Joe Heschmeyer.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com. Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. One of the nice things about working at Catholic Answers is so many nice people come to visit us. And today, young people from NET Ministries, National Evangelization Teams, are with us. And so we got to hear from a couple. Maybe we'll get to hear from a couple more before we end today. But your calls are also welcome, 888-318-7884. And now is time for Thomas to come in and ask a question from TikTok. You know TikTok as the social media site that I've been told steals all your information and sells it to the communist Chinese. I don't know about these things. I'm not a technical person, but there are a lot of Catholics on there. And then there are a lot of people who have questions for Catholics. So in a little segment we like to call TikTok for Peter the Rock. Thomas, go ahead with your question.
Not bad, Si. I give that name a 6 out of 10 on your scale.
6 out of 10. That's probably the highest I ever got from you, Thomas.
On your scale, though. Important qualification.
Okay.
Yeah. So for those who don't know, we are on TikTok. It's pretty straightforward. Our username is @CatholicAnswers. You can find us right there. And I'll usually take these questions from people who leave comments or ask us direct questions. And I'll take them on here, ask the question to the guests, and then I'll take the question, turn it into a clip, post it to TikTok so that person gets their question answered directly. So Joe, the question we have for you. This person wants to know, is it okay for Catholics to read books that aren't Catholic or Christian?
But let's start with this. St. Paul clearly did. We have at least 3 quotations of pagan poets from St. Paul. In Acts 17, he quotes Erastus. In 1 Corinthians, he quotes Menander. And in Titus, he quotes Epimenides. And so we know that he was clearly reading these pagan poets, whether as a Christian or before that as a Pharisee, and then quoting them. He knew them well enough to quote them as part of his argument. The second thing is often like for apologetics purposes, right? Like I bet if you were to look at any Catholic apologist's reading list, it's going to be a lot of weird atheist books and non-Catholic arguments against Catholicism and the like. So there are all sorts of legitimate reasons to read non-Catholic material. But there's also reasons to be hesitant about that. So I mentioned that Paul quotes Menander, one of these pagan poets. What he quotes him for is in 1 Corinthians 15:33, that bad company corrupts good morals. So if you're reading stuff that's impure, if you're reading stuff that leads you down a sinful road in terms of making you more violent or more coarse or more lustful or more whatever, well, don't read that. If it's giving you a negative worldview, if it's shaping you in a way contrary to Christ, don't read that. Like, be renewed in your mind. And so read things that are pure and good and beautiful, but don't be afraid of listening to maybe challenges to the faith and figuring out how to respond to them. So just figure out why you're reading what you're reading, why you're watching what you're watching, and let that be kind of your guide star rather than what was the religion of the person who created it.
Makes a lot of sense. St. Thomas would have had a really hard time writing a lot of the Summa if he wasn't allowed to read anything that wasn't Catholic.
Exactly. He regularly quotes Jewish philosophers like Menides. He quotes Aristotle, who's a pagan. He quotes all sorts of non-Christians. And the whole reason is because faith and reason point you to God. And so reading Aristotle can actually draw you closer to Jesus, as strange as that may sound, because he reveals something about the nature of the world. And I would say the same thing could be true about reading Einstein. The same thing could be true about, you know, reading anybody who understands the nature of the world in some important way. If it helps you to grow in reason, it actually is drawing you closer to God.
All right. Thanks, Joe.
Thanks, Thomas. And that concludes the segment we call TikTok for Peter the Rock. Now we go to Bob in Houston, Texas, listening on the Guadalupe Radio Network. Bob, thanks for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Joe Heschmeyer.
Why does the Catholic Church continue to go against what the Bible says regarding Jesus' brothers and sisters from Mary? You know, I think it's in Matthew where when he went back to Nazareth, you know, the people thought he was wise, but they thought, my gosh, he's from here, isn't he? How could he know so much? Doesn't he have brothers named Joseph and Jose and Judas? And aren't his sisters here also with us? I mean, they name the names of his brothers and sisters from Mary. And the other thing is, are we supposed to believe that Mary didn't have sex with Joseph anymore? I mean, that it was such a terrible thing that, oh, no, she wouldn't have sex with Joseph because she was the bride of the Holy Spirit. I mean, and Joseph just put up with it. He didn't care whether he had sex with Mary or not. Are we supposed to really believe that? I mean, this is
yeah,
a big
great question.
Problem.
Oh, great. I would love to answer this question. Let's take it apart piece by piece. First, when Jesus goes back to Nazareth, you're right, in Mark 6, they say, is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary, and brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon, and are not his sisters here with us? And the way we use brother and sister, it would be like, well, obviously, those are the children of the same parents. But we know that can't be true. You know why? Because Mark goes on. And in Mark 15, verse 40, he mentions that the women standing from afar, remember, Mary's at the foot of the cross, but there were also women looking on from afar, among whom were Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James the Younger, and of Joseph. Ha! So James and Joseph, those brothers of Jesus, have a different mom. And they definitely don't have the same dad because Jesus doesn't have a biological dad. So they don't have the same mom or dad. They are not what we would normally call brothers in English. And the trick here is that Jews use brother and sister to refer to a whole mess of relationships we would not, because we've got a much richer vocabulary. We've got words like cousin and nephew and uncle. But if you go back to Genesis, you'll notice Abraham and Lot are also described as brothers, even though we know Lot is actually the son of Abraham's brother. We would say uncle and nephew. They didn't have words for uncle and nephew. They call them all brothers. That's the first answer. Second, you asked about, and I'll add to that. In John 19, at the cross, Jesus entrusts Mary to the apostle John, who's a non-relative. But under both Christian and Jewish religious obligations, one of the first and foremost is to take care of your family, because the one who doesn't do that is worse than a non-believer, we're told. That's, we're told that both in the New Testament and in the Talmud. So both Jews and Christians would take very seriously this need to take care for your aging father and mother. The Ten Commandments then says, honor your father and mother. That's more of what it has in mind than like little kids obey your parents. So in other words, for Jesus to entrust Mary to a non-relative means she could not have had any other children, because it would have been an enormous scandal, an enormous controversy, as a faithful Jew to be told your mom is going to go live with this other non-relative because you're not going to take care of her. So that's the second thing. The third, you say, well, is it really possible to believe that, you know, Mary and Joseph weren't having sex? And the answer is, yeah. So to understand this, you got to understand that just like the word brother doesn't work the same in Jewish culture in the first century and in modern English, the same is true with marriages. Jewish marriages had two steps, Ketuvim and the Nevim. That first, you would contract the legal marriage, and then you'd have anywhere from 3 months to a year to arrange to actually live with your new wife, because you didn't have like a bachelor pad. And so Mary and Joseph are already married when the angel appears to Mary. So they just aren't living together yet. We know this because Matthew 1 refers to Joseph as her husband Joseph at the time of the Annunciation. That they're not just engaged the way we would do it in the 21st century. They're actually legally married, and they were allowed to have sex. Jesus is able to go into the temple because he's not viewed as being born out of wedlock, because people assume Joseph is his father. Okay, so that's important background. Mary and Joseph, legally married, able to be having marital relations, and yet we're told they're not. In Luke 1, when the angel Gabriel tells Mary that she's going to have a baby, she says, how can this be since I know not man, that I have no relations with a man, is another way to translate that. So she's saying, even though she's a married woman, she and her husband are not engaged in marital relations. The angel Gabriel doesn't tell them they have to pause until Christmas. There's nothing like that. But there, she's clearly a virgin, and Isaiah 7 promises a virgin will conceive and a virgin will bear a child. And so Mary's a virgin for reasons apart from the angel's message, even though she's already legally married. So this seems to be, but here we're on less clear ground, it seems to be something like a temple promise or some kind of pledge. We know from the Dead Sea Scrolls that there were women who would take a vow of virginity in the temple and make some kind of binding pledge. St. Paul refers to widows taking a pledge like this after their husbands die. So if Joseph is married to Mary but doesn't expect to have sexual relations, there's no bait and switch going on. The last thing I would say is just more of a prudential thing to think about. In God's good providence, it doesn't really make sense to say he's going to have Mary have one child who is God and then have a bunch of human children who have to live with an older brother who is God. That it would actually be seemingly an injustice to those other children in terms of their ability to receive the love and attention from their parents, their ability to measure up. All of those things would be severely compromised. I mean, ask any pastor's kid how hard it is to share parenting with a congregation. And now imagine that you're sharing parenting with God himself, who's your older brother. So I think it's partly a prudential thing. We also see places like Isaiah 44, where it talks about the temple gate, that once the Lord goes through it, no one else goes through it. The early Christians viewed that as a prophecy about Mary, because Jesus is the new temple, as he says in John 2. So there's a whole wealth of things that point to the fact that the so-called brothers of Jesus aren't his biological brothers, and that there's really good reasons to believe that there was already some kind of pledge of virginity, and that Mary's perpetual virginity is believed in by the earliest Christians for really good biblical reasons.
So, Bob, it doesn't seem that it's impossible to hold the Catholic belief and to accept what the Bible teaches. What do you make of that, Bob?
Well, I totally disagree with most of it. I mean, to assume that the only brother that Jesus could have had, his name was Joseph, that's ridiculous. Surely there were more Josephs in Nazareth than one, but it doesn't say,
Joseph.
The Bible doesn't say that this is Joseph from the family. It doesn't say that. It just says Joseph.
That's a good question. Hegesippus, who is a second century Christian author, there's a few pieces of biblical evidence we're going to put together here. Because the woman referred to as Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, Joseph, not Joseph. Joseph is a common name. Joseph only appears in this one spot. Joseph, his mother is Mary. She's also referred in the parallel account as Mary, the wife of Clopas. Hegesippus, second century author, writing in the 100s, tells us this Clopas is St. Joseph's brother. Now, we don't know that part for sure, but if that's true, it would explain it, that James and Joseph are Jesus's cousins, that they both married women named Mary, that Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, and Mary, the mother of Jesus, are different people. But James and Joseph only appear twice. They appear in a pair, and they seem to be referring to the same people, and they have a different mother and a different father than Jesus.
Bob, thanks very, very much. If you'd like, Joe has a book called The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. We'd be happy to send you a free copy of it. Just hang on the line if you want it, and we'll send it to you. Right now, I got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Joe Heschmeyer on Catholic Answers Live.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
EWTN, helping people grow in their love and understanding of God.
I just want to share that 5 years ago, my lovely warrior princess and saint of a wife and I decided to adopt a little girl through foster care. She is the perfect round out of our family of three boys and her. Yes, there are challenges. Very grateful today for all the blessings that he has shown our family.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. I don't think you convinced Bob, but let me just ask you this, Joe. From the conversation, it seemed to me like there's two positions you could take. One, I disagree with the church, what the Catholic mm-hmm. Church says on this, or what the Catholic Church says on this can't possibly be reconciled with the Bible. The second of those does not strike me as reasonable, because it's not like we haven't thought this through over 2,000 years. Like, nobody ever did the math.
Right. The idea is that there is this Bible verse that was so obvious that we 21st century Christians read it and immediately understand Jewish family life. And that idea should immediately give us pause to say, wait a second, weren't there people much closer in time and culture than we are today? And if they didn't read it that way, then we're wrong. I mean, it really is kind of that easy, that even if you're talking about secular literature, you'll find like these ancient accounts of male-male friendship, and people are like, they must have been homosexual lovers. And it's like, well, maybe things were just different back then, and like men were closer in a non-sexual way, and that we're viewing things through corrupted eyes ourselves. And so part of that's just having the humility and reading the Bible, or really any text. C.S. Lewis talks about this. His argument against liberal scholarship is that when we're further away in terms of culture, in terms of age, in terms of worldview, in terms of language, in terms of all of these things, the odds that we're going to understand things better than the early Christians is fleeting. The odds that we're going to understand Shakespeare better than Shakespeare's own contemporary is fleeting. And so that's the first, just like approach it with humility, that maybe the earliest Christians understood something we don't. And then when you find out that the earliest Christians laughed at the idea that Jesus had brothers and sisters, that should give us serious pause. So St. Jerome has this book called Against Helvidius. Now, Helvidius is one of the earliest people we find arguing that Jesus had brothers and sisters. And Jerome's response is really shocking. He says, I was requested by certain of the brethren not long ago to reply to a pamphlet written by one Helvidius. I've deferred doing so not because it is a difficult matter to maintain the truth and refute an ignorant boor who has scarce known the first glimmer of learning, because I was afraid my reply might make him appear worth defeating. Now, that's a really kind of like, Jerome's not known for his kind of sweet style. He's really acidic as a writer, but he just thinks this is the dumbest argument imaginable. And so did the other Christians in the fourth century, that the early Christians didn't read the same text that modern Protestants are reading and say, obviously this meant this. And they answered every one of the arguments Protestants were throwing out. Like, I have not heard an argument against Mary's perpetual virginity that St. Jerome hadn't already answered back in 383. And Yet these arguments are rediscovered and rediscovered, and every time the person rediscovering them thinks it's some slam dunk against Catholicism, just because they don't have enough learning to know, yeah, these questions have been answered a long time ago. You just have to know a little bit more about the culture. You have to know a little bit more about the language, whatever that is. Or you just have to have more kind of humility and respect for the sources that you're dealing with.
Let's go to Eric then in Plano, Texas, watching on YouTube. Eric, I'm glad you're here. Eric's on line four. Go ahead, Eric, with your question.
Yeah, Joe, wow. That discussion with my fellow Texan was amazing. You did such a good job. One of the things Texans have a problem with sometimes is addressing things with humility, but you certainly did a good job for me.
Oh, thank you. You know, let's just acknowledge Catholic Protestant issues aside, I think all non-Texans were probably really wowed to hear a Texan say anything that began the problem my fellow Texans have. That was really stunning from the Northern 49.
Yeah, Joe, I actually talked to you at the Catholic Answers Conference, and you were as great in person as you are on the phone. So I encourage everybody to go to the conference. It's fantastic.
Wow, I like this call, Eric. I might have just asked two questions. I don't know. I'm really enjoying all this.
Here's my question. At Mass this weekend, we had a great homily. One of the discussions was about Jesus talking to the thief when he said, "You will be with me in paradise." And so I'm reading that, and I'm thinking, well, you know, the thief gets to avoid purgatory or this day in paradise. Does that mean, one, the thief didn't have to go to purgatory, and does that mean that Jesus went to heaven that day?
That's a great question. And let me begin by saying there's a confusion in how the word day is used in Scripture, right? Second Peter 3, verse 8, "But do not ignore this one fact, beloved, that with the Lord one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day." When we're talking about the state of a soul separated from a body, your experience of time is not going to be the same as the experience of time you have in the body. That the way we normally experience time is bodily. And so you get a little taste of this when you're dreaming. When you're dreaming and you're cut off from the external senses, time can move at a really fascinating kind of speed. I mean, I had a dream once that seemed to take a week, and I woke up and it had been one night. And people have those kind of experiences all the time, that when you don't have that external check of hours and minutes and the earth's rotation, all that stuff. So all that's to say, when we're dealing with the spiritual reality, when we're talking about God, 1,000 years is like a day is like 1,000 years. We know a few other things as well, because we know, for instance, what happened to Jesus after Good Friday, and that's that he descended into the realm of the dead. He preached to the souls who were waiting liberation in what's called Sheol, the abode of the dead. In Ephesians 4, verse 8, St. Paul says, "Therefore it is said, when he ascended on high, he led a host of captives, and he gave gifts to men." And Paul comments on this in saying he ascended, what does it mean but that he also had descended into the lower parts of the earth? He who descended is he who also ascended far above the heavens. In other words, that at Good Friday, Jesus descends into Sheol, into Hades, and he takes all those people who'd been awaiting liberation, who are called captives because they hadn't yet entered into the realm of God, who are in Luke 16 referred to as being in the bosom of Abraham, and he brings all of those people with him to heaven. But even that ascension is actually broken up, as we know, by 40 days. So even there, he on Easter Sunday, he has not yet ascended to the Father, as he says to Mary Magdalene. He says, "Remember, don't hold on to me because I've not yet ascended to the Father." That's in John 20. In 1 Peter 3, we get an account of this as well. In verse 18, Peter says that Christ died for sins once for all, and then he was put to death in the flesh, made alive in the spirit, in which he went and preached to the spirits in prison. And so that's very clear that Christ has the descent on Holy Saturday. That's what we commemorate on Holy Saturday, that then leads to the ascent. The first ascension, if you will, is the resurrection, and is completed in his ascension into heaven. So does that make sense that what he's promising the thief is not you and I are going to immediately enter the full presence of the beatific vision? You know, we're going to immediately ascend into heaven. He's not promising that because he's got a different spiritual journey he's going to be on.
Eric?
When I consider what you said in humility and not thinking I'm an omniscient Texan in 2022, It makes perfect sense.
Well, you're an awful nice Texan, Eric. You are an awful nice Texan. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, guys.
Please call Love back. That was a real joy.
Let's see if we can get Jake in Memphis, Tennessee on before we have to go. Maybe we can get Jake and somebody else. We'll see how this goes. Jake watching on YouTube. Jake, you there with us?
Hello? Can
no,
you hear me?
Oh, hi, Jake. Yeah. Now I can hear you. Go ahead with your question for Joe Heschmeyer.
Thank y'all. Yeah, I am. I come from a Reformed Protestant tradition, but I'm in RCIA after reading my way through the early church and for the past couple of years, and a lot of thanks to Catholic Answers team. But my question is in regards to praying to Mary and the saints is a kind of a big hurdle still left for me. And I understand kind of some of the basic arguments, like it's just like asking a friend to pray for you. You know, like that's why you don't have to go directly to God. And I think that makes sense. But one difference that I've had a challenge overcoming is like my friend is physically and is right next to me. And the saints aren't necessarily there. So in my action of praying to them, it feels that I'm ascribing to them an omnipotence or an omnipresence that doesn't seem right, you know, coming from my background, at least, as I'm just trying to learn through that. Does that make sense?
So I would say to that the first thing to remember is what I just said, actually, to the last caller, that these spiritual realities, the experience of time is not going to be the same for spiritual beings or for souls detached from bodies, that our experience of time is not going to be the same. That for the saints to know anything, they're not going to receive it through their senses the way you and I would receive things through our senses. So for the saints to enjoy the presence of God, for the saints to hear our prayers, all of that is a spiritual enlightening that happens through the power of God. Does that make sense? Like, that's a really important point that I think we don't ever talk about. That the saints, to do anything, including see God, are being spiritually enlightened. They're not seeing him with bodily eyes because, with the exception of Mary, they don't have their bodies reunited with them. So that's the first thing. The second is that spiritual beings, as we just said, experience time differently. The book of Revelation refers to the devil as the tempter of the whole world. That is, the devil can tempt you here or over there. I mean, he can tempt every one of us on the planet. And in saying that, we're not ascribing him omniscience, we're not ascribing to him omnipresence, but we are saying that the mode of spiritual presence that a spiritual being has is going to be different. All that's to say that we are not ascribing to the saints anything more than we would ascribe to an angel, including a fallen angel, and we know from Scripture that the saints in heaven are above angels. Do you not know that we'll be judging angels, St. Paul says. So that we're going to be in a more glorified position than the angels are, and the angels are able to hear our prayers. The angels are able to interact with us, both angels and, unfortunately, the demons. So that's what I would say to that. That if you understand kind of that spiritual realm, that's, I think, what the ticket is. But it's totally understandable that because we're used to imagining the saints, you know, kind of being in an attic far away, that, you know, they're just like us bodily, they experience things through their senses, and they're just like in bodily heaven. Well, it's not quite like that yet. The glorified body is going to be reunited at the resurrection, but right now they're disembodied. And so their mode of experience is very, very different than what we're used to imagining.
Does that work for you?
That's really helpful. Thank you all.
Jake, do you have a copy of Joe's book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church?
I do, but I don't have the Pope Peter book.
Hey, oh, you that was a good move, Jake.
I didn't know you were shopping today,
well,
Jake. Okay, fair enough. Send him the Pope Peter book, please, Edgar. Thanks very much. We got a whole bunch more calls on the line. And if you're on the line, hang on. We'll get to you right after this. And if you haven't called yet, just a couple lines open, 888-318-7884. Plus, we'll hear more from the Net Ministries folks asking their questions. Right back with more Open Forum with Joe Heschmeyer on Catholic Answers Live.